Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Hi, I'm Dr. Mary Claire Haver, a board-certified OBGYN and menopause specialist. My new podcast, Unpaused, is the place for bold, unfiltered conversations about what it really takes for women to thrive in the second half of life. Every week, I sit down with medical experts, cultural icons, and powerhouse women to talk about what really matters: your health, your power, and your future. We're covering hormones, identity, finances, relationships, and so much more. New episodes drop every Tuesday. Listen to and follow Unpaused with me, Dr. Mary Claire Haver, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
It is 7:14, beautiful week ahead, and then it turns really cold by next weekend. So if you like the cold weather, you can look forward to that. Michael Deliberto joins us now, agricultural economist with the LSU Ag Center, also an associate professor in the Department of Agricultural Economics and Agribusiness on the Baton Rouge campus. How you doing, Professor?
Oh, I'm doing good, Tommy. How are you this morning?
I am okay, sir. Let's talk about Louisiana farmers and how are they doing with the shutdown, and then we'll go into tariffs.
Sure. Well, you know, Tommy, with the government shutdown that's in place, I think producers got a little bit of good news over the past week when the USDA announced that it would be opening some of its offices around the country at the Farm Service Agency to help producers get access to, one, conservation program payments, agricultural risk coverage payments, which were revenue support programs from the 2014 crop year that were made that wouldn't be available until October of 2025. So, you know, some key offices and the closures really affect the culture. But really, the biggest thing is the release of government reports out of the USDA that monitor crop progress, harvest progress, the size of the crops. With the Midwest, with the corn and soybean harvest coming online right now, the USDA has a critical role in providing information for the market that's fundamental in nature, the size of the crop, the number of exports we have, the number of crops that were shipped out of the port facilities. And that's news that the market needs to really maintain the rallies and the support and the strength of the market. So I think we're all hopeful that, you know, the shutdown is going to end hopefully pretty soon to where we can have a return to normalcy, if you will, to where this information can get out and, you know, it can provide producers some information on the market, but also it can help them set up their crop plans for next year already. This is a critical time when farmers in Louisiana, we've just finished harvesting our crops, but, you know, we're getting ready to meet with our agricultural lenders and our bankers to finalize plans for 2026 already. And with some of these FSA offices and USDA offices being closed, what about loan processing? Farmers that need to apply for financing for next year. So the stall in the backlog of all this, it is starting to concern, you know, some farmers in terms of being able to meet their financing needs for 2026 already.
So when you say conservation payments and reserve support payments, what are those?
Conservation reserve payments are conservation payments for working agricultural lands that producers enter into an agreement with USDA to where their marginally productive lands are set aside, they're taken out of production, and the USDA pays them a rental rate per acre, and that's done to maintain, say, like wildlife habitat, you know, grasslands, wetlands, and things like that, that really these lands wouldn't be well suited for production agriculture, but they do have benefit for, say, wildlife or conservation or soil health. So farmers can choose to put those lands in a conservation program to where they're able to generate some money from those lands instead of trying to invest all the money to get those marginal lands ready for crop production that really may not be a financially lucrative endeavor to pursue. But in Louisiana, some of those programs are done through private public partnerships through entities like Ducks Unlimited, where we're creating wildlife and waterfowl habitat, migratory bird habitat, et cetera. And it's really been a pretty strong source of diversification to maybe combat some of these low prices, high input costs that farmers are seeing for some of these marginal lands. Maybe they're more well suited for conservation, and those agreements are entered into between state agencies, federal agencies, and the agricultural producers here in Louisiana.
Somebody texted in, how dependent is the average farmer on payments from the federal government? Which is not a bad question.
Tommy, most farmers are going to say they want to farm for the market. Mm-hmm. These support payments that we have from the federal government, they are in no means a way to keep farmers in the black, to keep farmers farming from year to year in terms of, well, if the market's not there, I know that I'm getting these support programs. That's not the case. If anything, these support programs from a revenue or a price standpoint are only designed to trigger when certain market conditions present themselves. Say we have revenue that drops below 80% of the historical average. If the market price drops below a statutorily defined reference price in the farm bill, but these are only on a small share of the farm's acres. Farmers aren't paid and getting payments on every single acre they plant, because the World Trade Organization, how we support our farmers, you know, we play by the rules of the international commodity markets and saying that we don't provide any subsidies that would discourage or distort the market from planting crops every year. We much rather would see these returns come from high market prices. That's always the goal, but in these tight times that we're in now, these payments are really just being a bridge to let farmers secure their financing and to show some kind of cash flow for the next crop year. It is by no means a way that these farms can really survive long term in the absence of high market prices, if I'm answering your question.
Yeah, are they payments or loans?
Some are payments, but are made, again, on a fraction of those farm acres. So again, it's, you know, to put it in perspective, a payment may be, you know, $50 or $60 an acre, but you know, a farmer could sustain a loss anywhere of $150 to $200 an acre. So by no means is it a complete offset to say low yields or low prices.
But it's still a benefit that they're getting, right? From the government?
It is. And it's been around in ad policy, believe it or not. A lot of this ad policy is rooted all the way back to 1930s era farm policy, where the need was to support farm prices and farm incomes. Now we've moved to a more market-oriented approach in how these policies and programs are dispersed from the federal government to the producers, but they're really designed to support prices and incomes really in times of extremely low prices and farm incomes.
And I'm not trying to knock those payments at all. I'm just trying to, you know, everybody's paying attention to what the government's paying out now, and I'm just trying to get a handle on what it is exactly that they are paying it out. What kind of, let me take a break, we'll pick it up, we'll talk about tariffs when we come.
Mint is still $15 a month for premium wireless. And if you haven't made the switch yet, here are 15 reasons why you should. One, it's $15 a month. Two, seriously, it's $15 a month. Three, no big contracts. Four, I use it. Five, my mom uses it. Are you playing me off? That's what's happening, right? Okay, give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3 month plan. $15 per month equivalent required. New customer offer, first 3 months only. Then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
I'm Dr. Mary Claire Haver. Ready for honest conversations about thriving in midlife? Listen to and follow my new podcast, Unpaused, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm back. We're talking to Michael Deliberto, agricultural economist with the LSU Ag Center, also an associate professor in the Department of Agricultural Economics and Agribusiness on the Baton Rouge campus, about how Louisiana farmers are doing with the shutdown and tariffs. 720 traffic now, WWL. It is currently 7:26. Tommy Tucker, WWL, in the midst of the government shutdown, talking to Michael Deliberto, agricultural economist with the LSU Ag Center, also an associate professor in the Department of Agricultural Economics and Agribusiness on the Baton Rouge campus. Let's talk about tariffs. What kind of effect has that had on Louisiana farmers?
Well, Tommy, certainly with these tariffs, it's caused really a delay in exports, especially for, say, soybeans. Soybeans are one of our leading agricultural exports. China had traditionally been a large buyer of U.S. soybeans, and with this tariff uncertainty that, you know, was in the markets over the better part of, say, the last, you know, almost year or so, they've diversified to buying soybeans from Brazil. And with the absence of a major export customer like China out of the U.S. market, you know, that created a lot of uncertainty for the market because we were sitting on really two good years of soybean crops here in the U.S. So you had a lot of farmers that were holding their soybeans in hope that the market would maybe tick up, this trade situation would resolve itself. So we had a lot of crops in storage. And really, the soybean market in general, it was really a market that was sideways and struggling for direction. I mean, we had a lot of soybeans being used for domestic consumption, like soybean meal and soybean oil, biofuels here in the U.S., but it cannot make up for the lost export share that we're seeing right now. But with the news last week that China has agreed to buy as many as 12 million metric tons of soybeans from the U.S., you know, I think that's a positive sign for the industry. The soybean prices have rallied to a 15-month high, and I think that's a positive news for a U.S. soybean farmer and a Louisiana soybean farmer in general. So I think some of that uncertainty is starting to be alleviated. However, we still need those sales to actually get on the books. We still need those soybeans to leave U.S. ports and start going into China, and I think that's going to be a big win for agriculture. And there's also rumors that, you know, China's also looking to purchase milo, which is grain sorghum, and also cotton from the U.S. But, you know, so much of the crops we produce here in the U.S., like corn and soybeans, cotton and soybeans, excuse me, for instance, so much of that's going to be dependent upon global factors because we're a major exporter of both those products. So how much supply is out there in the world? Where are these major countries like China? If they're not buying from us, where are they buying from? So there's a lot of things that go into, you know, finding some clarity in this, but I think we're definitely moving in a step in the right direction to solving some of these trade disputes we're having.
What kind of lead time is there when it comes to planting soybeans and the market, et cetera?
Typically, soybeans in Louisiana, you know, our producers, we grow soybeans on over 1 million acres in the state, and soybeans is a plant that different varieties have different maturing dates, so mm-hmm. it allows producers to plant some early. Like soybean or sugarcane farmers would maybe plant soybeans early so they can get them out, say, in August before they want to go ahead and plant their sugarcane crop on their fallow lands. Guys in the Northeast and the Delta in Louisiana, they may plant soybeans later so they can harvest them, say, in October, for instance. So typically when we're looking at marketing plans for producers, they're identifying their cost of production when they plant soybeans. If they plant soybeans in, say, April, they're going to say, or May, they're going to say, okay, my cost of production is X dollars a bushel, therefore I'm going to need to get at least that out of the market. So when the market hits that, they can execute some sales. But over the past couple years, so input prices have been super high, driven by fertilizer, chemical, fuel prices. So the cost of production has been up. So farmers really are having to wait until the market can send them the signal to where they're actually going to generate a positive return on their crop. And it's been tough in the past 2 or 3 years, especially with soybeans being really below the cost of production from a price standpoint.
Very interesting stuff. Thank you, Michael. I appreciate your time and your insight. Michael Deliberto, agricultural economist with the LSU Ag Center, also an associate professor in the Department of Agricultural Economics and Agribusiness on the Baton Rouge campus. Hope we helped you understand some of that. We'll take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Wilson Alexander, LSU beat writer for The Advocate, spend some time talking about Brian Kelly's final days with the Tigers. Right now, time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Ian Ozan. 7:45, quarter till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, very, very happy to welcome in as our next guest to talk about Brian Kelly and the mess, the dumpster fire. It depends on, I guess, at what point you want to look at a dumpster fire. Wilson Alexander, LSU beat writer for The Advocate. Good morning, Wilson. Thank you for taking the time with us.
Thank you for having me on. Hope you're all doing okay.
We are, sir, and I hope you are, too. Tell me about, I don't even want to get in the middle of your story. It's such a well-written piece. I would just like you to kind of give us the highlights of it. Brian Kelly's problems, you know, it seems like reading the story to me, he billed himself as an attention to detail guy, but yet he really wasn't when it came to the things that maybe needed his attention. Would that be accurate or not?
I hadn't really thought of it in those exact terms, but as you say it, I think that that conclusion could possibly be drawn.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to go so far as to say as that's definitively it, because I think it's sort of, in some cases here, matters of opinion. But that seems to be a fair thing to say.
And let me just jump in real quick why I said that, because the part of when you meet a player and then you forget about it and then you say, well, it's been nice to meet you, to the player, that's like, well, bro, you don't even remember who I am, right?
Yeah, and that certainly is where a lot of people who have been around the program the past 4 years say that Brian Kelly fell short. And that was a common criticism of him, is that he did not connect with enough of his players. There were some players who said they had solid relationships with Brian Kelly. One, a former captain I spoke to, said he was close.
Mm-hmm.
He also acknowledged that it may have been because he was a captain. There was this sort of inability to connect with enough people and relate to enough people and really just win over enough people who are important around the program, and also just his players as well. But to go back to what you said about attention to detail, I hesitated because I know there were moments when he was did have the attention to detail that that you would want from a head coach. I think, though, that he wanted everybody else around him to kind of have the attention to detail and then be able to be maybe a little bit hands off. And that was as I was told by many people, too hands off. And maybe lack that attention to detail in that way, yes.
Did something else I got from reading your story is that, and it's going to sound terrible to say it, and I don't mean it too, but almost as though he was from the north and not one of us. It sounds terrible to say that, Wilson, but do you understand what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, that came up quite a few times, and it's sort of in his just, as people tried to describe his leadership style, his interactions with people, being, as one staff member put it to me, in a one-on-one situation, he was really good, where he could be funny and cordial and respectful. But then he would get into the bigger group settings, and another staff member used the word brash, where he would sort of raise his voice, and it felt maybe a little bit performative.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that just didn't translate. And people from the moment he got hired, they talked about, oh, this doesn't feel like a good fit and all of that. And I guess ultimately in terms of his personality, maybe it wasn't. One person said that a longtime sort of current staff member, that Kelly brought in some things that needed to be done and did some things really well. This particular person thought that his messaging was always good. He brought in some structure that needed to be in place at the time when he took over after the end of the Ed Orgeron era, but that ultimately LSU lost its edge.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back. One other thing I got from your article is that he kind of had one foot in, one foot out, and you're kind of lost if you're in no man's land, right? You're neither fish or fowl. Maybe I'm reading the wrong thing. I don't know, but we'll pick it up when we come back. Talking to Wilson Alexander, LSU beat writer for The Advocate. Got a great piece at NOLA.com about the inside goings-on behind Brian Kelly's tenure and his firing and the differences between when he was at Notre Dame and here. And I think it's a very insightful piece. We'll take a break, pick it up. We come back 7:50, 10 till 8. Traffic now, WWL. Might help if I turn my microphone on. 7:56, 4 till 8. Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Wilson Alexander, LSU beat writer for The Advocate. He's got a tremendous article written at NOLA.com that you can go back and read if you like. I would suggest you do. Did Brian Kelly have enough of a hand in what he wanted to do? And I mentioned that he had one foot in, one foot out. I think he did in terms of culture. I think he did in terms of managing the organization. I think maybe the administration might have had one foot in, one foot out. Here's the thing I'm trying to say, Wilson. I'm all for responsibility with authority. It's like, you know what? If you're going to hold me responsible, by God, I'm going to pick my own staff. If you don't like it, fire me. Of course, there was the buyout consideration that factors into this as well. But did he have enough of it, of his own say, or were they trying to protect him from himself?
Well,
That's a lot of questions, huh?
Yes.
Bobby Hebert taught me that, Wilson. There. Bobby Hebert taught me how to ask those questions.
Well, to answer the last one, did he have enough to say? Yeah, he had a hand in everything. I will say, okay, if you look back to the beginning of Brian Kelly's tenure, he was given the permission, the ability to shape that staff the way that he wanted. Mm-hmm. And that included getting rid of a lot of longtime LSU staff members, Tommy Moffitt, Corey Raymond. Obviously, Blake Baker was on staff, and they let him go and then had to bring him back. Austin Thomas was already there. And then in 2023, bringing him back, a lot of those guys back, was something that was not only a Brian Kelly decision. Scott Woodward was heavily involved in that. And then as the things began to morph, you know, and LSU brings in Austin Thomas to sort of run the roster management and the GM and all of that. I think Kelly was okay with that, but it certainly, as he said before, was different than anything he had ever previously done in his career, and that's not a surprise. He's been a head coach for 30-plus years. This is not how college football has worked up until recently. So he had to adapt, and I think in some ways, as some staff members said, he did adapt. It just never really worked. I think the reason it never really worked, maybe not might not quite be so much because of that, but because his style works if you have really good assistant coaches around you. Mm-hmm. You look back to Notre Dame the last 5 years when they won 10 straight games in a row. His defensive coordinators, he had three straight. All of them are now head coaches at power programs and having success. If he's going to delegate the way that he does, everybody's got to be really good. And there was always an issue with the staff at one every single season, questions about somebody needing to get fired here at LSU.
Do you think Frank Wilson has any shot at the job at all?
If LSU wins out,
yeah,
then maybe it becomes a discussion. I think where things stand at this point, most likely it would be a long shot, I would say at this point.
Hey, look, I appreciate you coming on. I'm very sorry about your loss. I mean that sincerely, Wilson.
Thank you so much.
I
appreciate y'all having me and hope you have a good rest of your day.
God bless you, man. Thank you. Wilson Alexander, staff writer for NOLA.com. Go read that story. Brian Kelly's ended LSU inside the Tigers coach demise. Very well researched, very well written. We'll take a break, come back, talk to Jason Williams with this funding mess. Talk about a dumpster fire with the city. He's worried about his department. We'll talk when we come back, WWL.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
I'm Dr. Mary Claire Haver, and my new podcast, Unpaused, is the place for bold, unfiltered conversations about what it takes for women to thrive in the second half of life. Listen to and follow Unpaused, available now wherever you get your podcasts.